This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, a look at Visits Locale's efforts to boost tourism.
So our mission is to increase tourism into the region and then make sure that we are responsible about that. So how do we also balance the needs of the residents?
Also, the challenges of enhancing monarch butterfly habitats on the Central Coast.
The grove doesn't really offer the protection that it once did to the monarchs when they come to overwinter here. So we want to reestablish those groves functioning properly so that monarchs that are here are nice and safe from winter storms and things of that nature.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, December 16th, 2024. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with peace, love, and pets.
Welcome to KCBX Public Radio. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. This is Peace, Love, and Pets, and I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society. My guest today is Reese Jansen, Executive Director with Sun Care Foundation. What is that, you may be asking? We're going to tell you all about it, and you're going to learn some other great things that are going on in our community. And welcome, Reese, to Peace, Love, and Pets.
Thanks, Robin. Hi, everybody.
Okay, so let's just get going. Let us know, what is Sun Care Foundation? What are you doing in the community? Of course, tell us all about it, but of course, we're interested in the pets in this community. And I know we've worked with you at Woods a few times, so I'm excited to have you in here to talk a little bit more about your great programs and all the things that you offer to this animal-friendly community.
Well, thank you. Yeah, Sun Care Foundation, being the executive director of an organization most people don't know what it does, is interesting. But really, we're a nonprofit that operates 4 to 5 other programs underneath it, including New Life Canines, Thousand Hills Pet Resort, Gentle Touch Pet Training, and we have a car donation program called Mission Cars. Really, the whole mission of all these programs is to inspire hope and save lives through the healing power of the human-canine bond. So we do that with pet boarding, pet training, daycare, and the car programs that all work to fund and support our service dog organization that trains service dogs for people with PTSD in the veteran and first responder community. And what's really fun is we do that all locally. So we have been in San Luis Obispo since 1999 over on Buckley Road, and really started with one program and then added another program and added another, and really piecemealed it all together. And it's my job to try to take all these different programs and try to get them all going in the same general direction and supporting each other and supporting the community, hopefully, with just really good pet care that goes on to make a difference in the lives of the people who get our service dogs.
Awesome. Well, let's talk a little bit about those service dogs. I was lucky enough earlier this year to come and be a part of one of your amazing graduation ceremony services. Definitely needed quite a few Kleenexes. Mm-hmm. It was very moving, touching, inspiring. So tell us a little bit more about that and how that program works. I know working at an animal shelter, working with animals, it seems a daunting task to try to take dogs and train them to be service dogs with,
It takes a village for sure. Yes. So we have been doing our service dog program since 2014. Initially, it was just over at our facility on Buckley Road. Our program has done some mentoring for young people, and it was kind of a project for some of the young men who are living out there to practice dog training skills. And it turned into a full program as we were successful, right? So we had maybe 5 or 6 dogs that we were able to produce. And then somewhere along the line, someone mentioned, hey, why don't you go use CMC? Why don't you use incarcerated men who are out there, start a dog training program? And that was not in the original design, but has become just so impactful and powerful and crucial to what we do. So you talk about the impact of, you know, someone struggling with PTSD, getting a dog is already pretty powerful enough. But when that handoff from the trainer to the recipient is done by someone who's been incarcerated and without hope, and then they've had this dog for about 2 years from when they're puppies and all that, that's what's really special. So generally, the pathway for a dog is at about 8 weeks, we will bring a dog into our program who's purpose-bred for service work. almost always labs lately. Mm-hmm. We've done some retrievers. We've even done a doodle and maybe a shepherd or two even if I go way back in our history. But our labs come in at 8 weeks and they are with our trainers at CMC from 8 weeks to about a year and a half, Monday through Friday, every week. Those dogs do well in that environment because of the consistency and just the stability and the routine of that place. So on the weekends, though, they do need some public access and experience. So we have a team of volunteers, and we're always looking for more, to take the dogs just on the weekends. So expose them to what's Costco like, you know, what's a concert like, anywhere that a future recipient may need to go that our service dogs need to be comfortable and successful in. We need to practice that on these weekends for the first 2 years of training. And then at the end of the weekend, our volunteers can return them to CMC, and then they spend a week working on specific skills with our handlers and repeat and repeat and repeat until it's time for finish work.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got to witness some of that. And, you know, I get to be a part of the human-animal bond that I love and I just appreciate so very much. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that I do love dogs so much is they are so not judgmental. They, you know, they bond with those incarcerated men. And I got to see that with my own eyes. Those dogs were so locked in with them. They were so bonded to them. They were, you know, just really, you could feel that bond and connection and what the dog gets and the person gets,
right,
and then the person that they're going to go to. I think when I was there, there was a previous fireman who got a dog. You know, there was a couple different stories, and, you know, it's just such a remarkable program that you guys can pull that off. And, you know, it's also a great reminder of how adaptable these dogs are. I think, you know, for me, thinking of taking my own owned dog into a prison type environment, I would be like, oh my gosh, this could never work. But because you bring them in at such a young age and they adapt to it, and that is their home during the week.
Absolutely. And it creates some funny things you wouldn't expect with the dogs, and what they might be comfortable with and skittish with is a little bit flipped from what you might experience over at Woods, because they're very comfortable with big burly men with keys jangling and you know, heavy boots, and but they maybe don't know what kids are like.
Yeah,
you know, and kids are very interesting to them.
Sure.
The former west side of CMC, which is now closed, but we were there for a while before we had to move to the east, there were feral cats everywhere, so they did get some exposure to that.
I'm well aware.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We've altered many.
You're right over there. So in prison, there are certain things that are really, really great for helping the dogs know how to be resilient. But you just have to laugh where they can handle some, you know, big correctional officer, but a 5-year-old, you know, wanting to pet them is like very, very strange. Yeah. Yeah. So.
And I do have to also shout out the staff at CMC.
Right.
I think at first when I heard about the program, and I knew, kudos to you guys for pulling it off. I know that took a lot of work, and it does take a lot of work to do something like that. And of course, the inmates are on board and excited, and they probably are very competitive of who gets to be a part of your program. But I was really impressed with the relationship between the guards, the prison staff, and the inmates and the dogs. Like, they're all, you guys are all in this together, and it wouldn't work if not one of those areas was on board and could see the benefit. Yep. I kind of thought, just like in a movie or something, the guards would be like, this goofy program, you know, but they were in it. They were supportive. They were getting emotional. I really was impressed. So one, thank you for letting me witness that myself and for the great work you're doing. Mm-hmm. And I got to, you know, I'm wondering if you have a favorite story. When I was there, I know there was a gentleman that had been there for a very long time, has been a part of the program for a long time, and his two daughters were there. And I'll probably cry now. But that was the first memory that came to my mind. They said a few words, and they said, like, this program has given us our dad again. You know, we didn't have him before. And this has changed him and given us, like, something to talk about and share and bond. And they have built a relationship now because they see the work that he has done and the changes he has made. So that, you know, blew me away. And they were all in tears, and we were all in tears. But, you know, just another example of, you know, it's not just a dog. Like, these animals can inspire and change and bring so much to our lives. Do you have a favorite story or an example? I know, probably too many.
Favorite, yeah.
Like an example to share or something that, you know, you might want to share with our listeners.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And it's just an honor to get to share these stories because the guys inside don't get to share the stories.
Right.
So I'll try to tell the stories in the best way possible. I can never compete with them. But really, all of the best stories are an opportunity for them to show that they're changed, for them to show, you know, hey, I'm not who I was. One early one in the program comes to mind. We had a gentleman who received a dog. He had been part of San Luis Obispo PD. And a lot of his PTSD came from being a photographer for accidents. Mm. Tough. And living locally and driving by any intersection that might bring up a memory, that kind of thing. So he was really, really having a hard time. He got Eddie, and Eddie's really changed his life. But being a police officer, going into prison to meet the men who trained Eddie was something that made him extremely nervous, extremely scared. You know, what are these guys going to think of me being a former police officer? And so going in there with all that kind of weight, and then instead of being met with dirty looks and hostility, to be embraced by these men, and then for them to collectively, you know, write a letter, make a speech and say, hey, there was a time where we would have wanted to, you know,
hurt you. We were working against you.
Exactly. You know? And now we get to show how much we've changed by giving you a dog that will potentially save your life. Mm. And that moment for him, where these guys went from being adversaries, like you were talking about, mm-hmm. with maybe the COs, correctional officers, but now they're teammates, mm-hmm. and that these men have given this person a gift. And I can't think of a better way of explaining the complete 180 shift for these men, mm-hmm. And for this person from, you know, the law enforcement community. And if we can break that wall down through that's the healing power.
That's a full circle
of the
human
canine bond,
for sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's all centered around, for them, Eddie. And it was about what's best for Eddie and how Eddie can be the best service dog possible to help Greg. So I loved it too.
Yeah.
It was pretty special.
And, you know, so much healing in that one dog, that one, you know, experience. I know it takes a long time to get there, but in that example, so much healing on so many people were involved.
And there's a part too where some of these men, because it's been a few years, have now been released and they're friends with this recipient and they hang out socially and they work on projects together.
That's awesome.
Yeah, people who would never have been friends and would have thought of each other as adversaries or our family now, really.
Love it. So I think if I understand right, so your New Life Canine program, which we're talking about and we admire, some of your other programs help raise funds to support that. So it's important to share some of those, like how people can, you might not think taking your dog to that training class or to get groomed or buying that car from Mission Cars or donating a car from Mission Cars. All of that is allowing these service dogs to go into these lives and this program.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. You're listening to Robin Coleman for Peace, Love, and Pets. She's talking to Reese Jensen of SunCare Foundation.
Talk a little bit about your training programs. I know you've added grooming recently. Mm-hmm. So tell us about people who have pets, some of the services they may be able to go and use.
Yeah. Well, every service dog costs tens of thousands of dollars. And our founders wanted to make a self-sustainable model where we do accept gifts and grants and we do need them and we count on them. But we wanted to be able to pay our own way somewhat as well. So if people want to support us in lieu of a donation, please come board your dog at Thousand Hills Pet Resort. Use our daycare. We did offer grooming starting about a year ago. And we also, about 3 years ago, incorporated Gentle Touch Pet Training, which had been down in Rio Grande, and merged with us. And we built a building for them, and they moved in 2021, which was, what a pandemic story
crazy
that
year.
Is. Yeah. But we did it, and it's been going really well, too. So especially if someone, you know, has puppy classes, we are offering that. We do all positive reinforcement training, clicker training. And the third way I would say you could support us would be if you had a car in your driveway and you wanted to donate your car to us. Mission Cars is our program that takes that car, finds a way to fix it up, sells it, and then the proceeds generally go to New Life Canines. But we're excited to offer that same service for other nonprofits, Woods being one of them.
Yes.
So if there's anyone who say they wanted to donate their car to Woods, you guys know Woods has a lot on their plate. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we help Woods by handling that car donation, and we actually split that donation evenly. Woods doesn't have to really do anything. They just get to receive half of the proceeds. And Mission Cars does kind of all that uncomfortable cleanup and DMV and selling and all that. And that half that Mission Cars takes in goes to New Life Canines.
Yes, so. And I can say we joined your program this year, and I think we've averaged a car or so a month just in the last few months of starting.
Yeah.
And I think we've done like one social media post and we put it on our website and been talking about it at events and things like that. And I will say, gosh, I don't know that many people who donate cars. In my mind, I was thinking that's not something that happens very mm-hmm. often, but you would be surprised. You would know better than I would. And our friend Michael, who runs Mission Cars, you know, he's always busy, always hustling, always making a deal, going to get a car, going to look at a car. But you guys do motorcycles, RVs, cars, and sometimes people have those older cars or they need a costly repair that maybe they mm-hmm. can't do. But I think it's important. It's just something that people don't think about. And then when they do have this, they're like, what do I do with it?
Right.
So, you know, you explained it, but I just want to remind people that share the word. It's a great way to support two great local organizations that are helping people and pets with it, which is everything that we stand for. So if you hear about somebody, a neighbor, a friend, a property that has a car or two that they are ready to move on from, it's a great. And then those cars really, Michael's told me several stories. Like, they're affordable cars for people once you guys put a little work into them. They're mm-hmm. affordable cars for people who might not be able to get a vehicle or afford a new car. So it really is another full circle
yeah.
moment where you're helping two organizations. You help the person. They feel good. They made a tax-deductible donation. And now this new family or this new person is able to get a vehicle to get to work or
yeah.
to school or whatever that might be.
Well, Slo County is a small town, and there's a lot of nonprofits here. And we didn't feel like we wanted to just hoard all these car donations. And we know that there's a lot where if I tried to hand you even a nice car, you know, wide-eyed, what do I do? Mm-hmm. So if we can be of service to our other nonprofit friends, especially animal organizations, but veterans organizations, or really anyone with a 501c3 status. So if there are other nonprofits listening, mm-hmm. We would love to help you as well
yeah.
and take that burden for you.
And I'll say we did it before with a more of a nationwide company. We had a link on our website. We never heard much about it. There might be a donation popped in our mailbox once in a while, but it wasn't something that we could really point people to a person.
Right.
And it feels really good now to be working with someone locally. Michael is on it. He's very responsive.
Yes.
He will get you lined up with a car or to bring your car in. And it's just nice because it can be a complicated process for people. Like mm-hmm. I'm always looking at a pink slip or trying to figure out, do I need to go to the DMV
sure.
or what do I do with this? So he's a great resource and he's available, and it's like a really quick and easy process. I've, you know, been able to talk to a few of our donors who have took advantage mm-hmm. of it. And it's just so nice to have a human that you can rely on to help you through the process and guide you as well. So shout out to Michael doing a great job with Mission Cars. And Woods is, you know, again, appreciative of that partnership that we started just a few months ago. So more information on that on our website, woodshumane.org, or your website. It sounds like you've got a couple different websites.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
I want to recap that you offer like doggy daycare just for like day fun drop off. Mm-hmm. And then you do more long term boarding as well.
We
Is
do.
That right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have grooming, of course. And then you have some great classes. I know you mentioned puppy class and then probably basic obedience. Are you guys doing other types of classes?
What's really popular with us is our nose work classes.
Ooh,
yeah, we do
dogs
agility,
love that.
Agility and nose work. So we'll call them our sport classes.
Okay.
So nose work is something I was not familiar with before 2021.
Okay.
And now I love it. They do go to all different corners of our property trying to look for places to hide, you know, odors for mm-hmm. the, you know, the dogs in those classes to search out. So they actually prefer stinky, weird, other like distracting scents. So I'll find them. Sometimes I'll go to lunch and my car has been deemed a scent, you know, search area. So we do offer those classes, and really you just buy per class. But our clicker training, our elementary classes, our puppy classes, those are going to be, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, and you buy the whole class up front. All of that training is with Gentle Touch, and their website is gentlepets.com. For the boarding and daycare, it's thousandnailspetresort.com. And for car donation stuff, it's missioncars.org.
Okay. And then I'm sure you have social media pages for those too. People can follow along on Facebook and Instagram.
I'm a bit of a Luddite, but yes, I know that there's Facebook, Instagram, and all that good stuff. We're really proud of our Thousand Hills Pet Resort TikTok too. Ooh. That has taken off recently. Don't ask me to contribute to
that. I think it was that Michael video yes. that you guys did that was trending, I feel like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If people are curious of how we keep giggling about Michael, yes. Check it out on there.
I really was giggling. I was like, okay, kudos. You know, Woods has a pretty good social media account. Yeah. But I was like, oh, okay, I see you.
Yes. I mean, leave it to the hands of our Gen Zers to run that, right? Yeah.
That was really fun. So go check them out. Anything else you'd like to share with our listeners we didn't cover?
Well, we just love being in this community. And we felt, you know, we've been here since 99. And we do feel like sometimes we're too well of a kept secret. Mm. So we do want to serve this community. We want to help with your human canine bond. Even if you don't have a service animal, we want to help make that relationship as good as possible for your benefit and for your pets.
Yeah, and keep them out of shelters, because basic obedience is something very often people give up a little too soon. They don't put in the training in the first few months of owning a pet, whether they're a puppy or an older animal. Those first few months are crucial. The first year for a puppy is truly just going to decide what that puppy, that dog is going to be for the rest of its life. So we're big fans of puppy classes. We love those nose work, because we'll get a lot of working breed dogs or high energy dogs, and people are like, well, I walk him, but he's still bored. Nose work is great for those dogs, you know, huskies, German shepherds, you know, border collies, some of those dogs that are working breed dogs, that hikes are fun and tug is fun and fetch is fun, but there is nothing, and they will be so tired after nose work class. Like, it really gets their senses going. It's like doing a, you know, a 2-hour hike in a I don't know how long your nose work classes are, but in 20 minutes of doing something like that, my dog used to just be conked out in the car on the way home from training classes before we even hit the parking, you know, left the parking lot. So big fan of training classes, and builds that bond, and also keeps dogs out of shelters that, you know, can just get a foundation of some obedience. And then you have a great dog for the remainder of their time. So, well, that's great. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing, and I hope people get involved. And again, you definitely could use some fosters and volunteers.
Always.
I think weekend fosters, such a short-term commitment, such a worthwhile cause. Maybe somebody can't take the responsibility of having a pet full-time right now. Maybe even fostering for a month or two isn't in their schedule, but I would encourage them to check your organization out to see if there are ways that they can get involved. And then hopefully, I'm sure you guys do some different fundraising events and fun events in the community, so hopefully they'll come out and support those as well. So as I wrap up here, I want to thank my guest, Reese Jansen with Sun Care Foundation. Thank you and your team for all the work that you do in the community helping people and pets. This time of year, Woods is working hard to find as many shelter pets homes before the holiday as we can. Adoptions in December just feel extra special. And as a reminder, there is always something that you can do to support the homeless animals in your community. Our social media posts, just sharing those is very helpful. If you could imagine 20 or 30 followers sharing the Facebook post, that just increased the reach of that adoptable animal, maybe by a couple thousand people. We are always accepting in-kind donations of things like new or used fleece or throw blankets. We use a lot of dog jerky treats at the shelter, cat and dog pill pockets to sneak that medication in on them, dog and cat toys, and we have our community pet pantry that we are sharing 1,000 to 2,000 pounds of pet food each and every month with our community partners and public members that love their pets but are going through something difficult and just need a bag of food or two to keep their pets fed. We accept open or unopened bags, any brand. You can drop them by daily at either location. And we also have Chewy and Amazon wish lists on our website. This time of year, we get a lot of calls asking what our shelter pets can use. So I just wanted to share that information with you. We recently helped a dog named Joker, who their owner was receiving services from Cap Slow at 40 Prado for over 10 months and included pet food from Woods. And they recently got into housing, and Woods provided a care package including toys, bed, blanket, food, harness, and leash to help make his new home nice and cozy. He loved his toy so much that he grabbed it with the tag still on and started carrying it around on his walks. So that is just some of the things that we're doing at Woods in this community. I want to wish you all a happy holidays from your friends at Woods. Follow us at woodshumanesociety.org and, of course, on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks for listening to Peace, Love, and Pets on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods. And don't forget, your new best friend is waiting for you at the shelter, and they all need a home before the holidays.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Meher Ali. Up next, CEO of Visits Locale, Kathy Cartier, shares insights about her nonprofit's tourism promotion efforts.
I'm Kathy Cartier, the president and CEO of Visits Locale.
How cool. And how long have you been here?
I've been here just over 3 years, so I came in March of 2021.
And before that, you were in Las Vegas?
I was in Vegas for 25 years. Wow. I worked at the Bureau there for 14 and was in healthcare prior to that.
Oh, interesting. And you grew up in upstate New York?
I did. Uh-huh. I grew up just south of Montreal, so right on the Canadian border in northern New York, near the Adirondacks. So a beautiful place to grow up.
Yeah. Little lake effect up there?
Little lake effect. I got tired of snow in April, so I had to move.
Was it Buffalo?
I went to school near Buffalo at St. Yeah. Bonaventure University.
They own all the snow there.
They have all the snow all the time.
So what made you decide to move to San Luis Obispo County?
The opportunity, I came here as a consultant for Visits Locale, working, overseeing the marketing efforts, and then was offered a full-time position and decided to stay. So actually moved here in June to be here full-time. It's a beautiful part of California, you know, the center of the Central Coast, and we live kind of a different life here in this part of the state.
Totally. And you get it. It is so special that on the one hand, you don't want to tell anybody about it. So you have a real quandary.
Yeah. Our job is to bring people here and have the community benefit from travel and tourism, and also to balance resident quality of life. Mm-hmm. So it's, how do we get people here at the right time? How do we spread them out throughout the region? We know one of the most beautiful things we have going for us is at the top of San Luis Obispo County is Ragged Point, where you're at the entrance to Big Sur. And so you get that cliff and that feeling of really the majestic Northern California. And then you come all the way down along Highway 1 and you see, you know, Morro Bay and Cayucas and all these beach towns. But coming all the way down to Pismo Beach, where you get the sandy beaches of Southern California, into Napomo and the agriculture, you just get a little bit of everything with wine country and beach. And it's a really spectacular place to live and work.
Yeah. For myself, about every 4 weeks, I'm covering on assignment some new state, in Missouri or whatever. Every time I come back, I appreciate San Luis Obispo County more. And it's like, wow, is this real?
Yeah, it's a beautiful place to live. What is nice is we talk a lot about time and distance because, you know, we have a lot of visitors that come from LA area or San Francisco. And for us, you know, if you're going 10 miles, it takes 10 minutes. Right. It is not the traffic of Southern California or Northern California. And so we talk a lot about time and distance and that you can go wine tasting and go to the beach.
In
and
the
there's
same
not
day.
A lot of places you can do that all in the same day.
The other day I was heading up to Paso Robles on 41 and a car was in front of me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like traffic jam.
We're a throwback.
Yeah. Talk to us about your mission and where you focus on and how you reach out to people that have not been here.
So our mission is to increase tourism into the region and then make sure that we are responsible about that. So how do we also balance the needs of the residents? And so we're inviting people through, you know, paid channels, through earned and owned channels. We have a social media strategy. We have a strong Instagram following where we can really show what we're all about. You know, it's very visual. and talk about all that we have to offer. We have so many crafters. We have so many people that are making amazing goods. And then we have a great culinary scene because we're so close to farming. Things are literally fresh. And so that's what we're responsible for. And we're trying to do that with a real responsible lens of how do we spread tourism throughout the region? How do we make sure that we're not having spots that are hitting up against over-tourism, which is not a problem for us? And how do we make sure that we tell the story of the whole region so that people want to go see more than one thing? They want to experience all that we have to offer. And so that's our mission, and we work real hard on that.
It seems to me it's self-filtering in that there are such a diversity of people that come wanting to savor a diversity of things, activities and whatnot.
That's right. So. And often people will come for one thing. You know, they may come to go to Hearst Castle or go to Sensorio and see the Field of Lights, which, you know, is the largest Field of Lights in the U.S. It's beautiful. And then they may realize, oh, okay, they've gone wine tasting. They've gone to Sensorio and Paso Robles. And then they want to go to Atascadero where there's a whole new food scene happening there. Or they may drive down to San Luis Obispo where you have Cal Poly. And so you have that whole university vibe. What's interesting and when we talk to visitors is how they will come maybe for one reason and then discover other things when they're here.
And you have a certain number of people that don't want to leave.
That's right.
Yeah, literally make a life-changing decision to stay.
Well, which is what I did, right? I came as a consultant and
there you go.
And here I am.
What a no-brainer, huh?
Yeah, well, it was it's an amazing place to live.
One curious question. I was up at Hearst Castle recently and the number of people there was down, markedly so. And they said it was because of the closure of Highway 1 through Big Sur. Has that affected you at all?
It's affected the northern county. We are fortunate in that Highway 1 is fully open in San Luis Obispo County. But there is a 7-mile stretch north of us, south of Monterey, south Big Sur, where they're still working on that road closure. Yeah. And so what we're doing is really talking about the messaging of you can have the full Highway 1 experience either south of Big Sur by coming through San Luis Obispo County or going to our neighbors up north, and you can have that experience from Monterey going north. And so there's an opportunity still to have the experience, but it's a messaging piece, and it's making sure that travelers know that you can still have that experience. There's only 7 miles of that entire roadway that's closed.
Right. You got to backtrack.
You have to go down and around.
Yeah. So one of my favorite places, and I'm sure you agree, is Ragged Point.
I love Ragged Point.
Wow.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, not only for just to visit, but a place to stay.
Yeah, and eat and really experience what California has to offer in the best sense of California, and where it's just beautiful.
They're still open.
They're still open.
But again, anybody from the north has to go south and then loop back north again.
But you get that beautiful drive across the 46. If you're coming from the north, south, and you loop around through Paso Robles, it's like you have an opportunity to go wine tasting, and then you can have great meals. You can come across the 46, which is such a beautiful drive, and then go up through Cambria, you know, go north through San Simeon, make your way past the elephant seals, and get to Ragged Point.
That's so cool. And then, like, Cambria, that kind of sells itself, too.
Yeah, Cambria's got Moonstone Beach, right? And it's just, it's a different kind of beach that is just so spectacular.
Let's talk South County for a moment. What's going on down there?
There's a lot happening in South County. So if you get to San Luis Obispo and then continue south, and you're going to go by Avila Beach, which we know is a beautiful little beach with its pier. You can eat on the pier. You can experience that whole sandy beach and then continue to Pismo Beach. And Pismo Beach continues to put money into the city and that experience. And so I noticed I live in Pismo Beach, and in Shell Beach, they decorated all of the lights I noticed the other night for the holidays. Just beautiful. It's a beautiful place to go and experience the beach in the holiday time period. Pismo's doing quite a lot. And then you continue on south to Napomo, and you're going to be in the agriculture piece.
What's out in Napomo?
The Dana Reserve. You can go out there and see that, adobe. You can spend some time having fresh fruits and vegetables. You know, as you know, we have farmers markets all year long here. So always an opportunity to have a little Santa Maria barbecue. And
way back in time, I just remembered Cecil B. DeMille's movie, like the Bible or whatever, was filmed
in Oceano.
Wow.
Yeah, the dunes, it's the only beach in California. You can drive on the beach. You can camp on that beach. You can have bonfires on that beach. And the dunes are an amazing kind of experience that you just don't expect. And all of a sudden, there you are.
Yeah, and it is truly world class. I mean, Hollywood uses it.
It's filming it. That's right.
Yeah. How about Old Town Arroyo Grande? How's that doing? I love that old town.
Yeah, they're doing great. You know, if you want to see a rooster, there you are, walking across the street all the time. But, you know, they have the swinging bridge. They have the entrance to go out to the lake. You can also have great meals right there. You know, they have a really nice culinary scene happening in Arroyo Grande. And little shopping, their main street with the shopping and the dining. It's just really fun out there.
Okay. Kathy's itinerary. You have a girlfriend that shows up. She's never been to the county. And you got one day. Where do you go? What's your itinerary?
Ooh, that's a lot. Well, you have to get up early because we have to be able to start early. And I think you go ahead and we have some breakfast in San Luis Obispo. And then we make our way up the coast. And so we will drive Highway 1 up through Morro Bay and Cayucas. That view driving into Cayucas from Morro Bay is spectacular, where it all opens up and you see the ocean. Mm-hmm. So we would take a ride up there, stop in Harmony, go into the little glass blowing shop, make our way up to Cambria, where we would see Moonstone Beach, maybe stop there for a minute, get a snack, carry on, go all the way to Ragged Point, because then you get to see the entrance to Big Sur and the cliffs, which is totally different than South County.
And the sea lions.
And this
isn't that cool?
The elephant seals are amazing. And the whales are running. You know, you could spot a whale while you're there. Then we'd come back down, probably have lunch right there in Cambria at Bridge Cafe, and then make our way back down across the 46 to Paso and stop and do a little wine tasting in Paso, and then make our way back down South County and probably go to Ember and Arroyo Grande for dinner, have an amazing dinner, and then we'd be done.
And that's one day.
And that's one day.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Back for a moment to social media. Does Facebook work for you? What is it, Instagram that works the best?
Yeah, we're on Instagram and Facebook. And really the story we're able to tell on those platforms is a visual story. So we're able to show people this is what we're talking about. And when people think about California, depending on if they've been to California or where they've been in California, they may have a different impression of what California is. Mm-hmm. And what is so special about this region is it's not overpopulated. You know, there's not too much traffic. But
isn't that a miracle?
It's unbelievable. And the natural beauty of the place is spectacular. So those social media platforms allow us to tell a visual story, which then allows people to think and see themselves here and plan.
Is it kind of self-filtering, you know, the population and people moving here and whatnot is just far enough away that it
kind of... We're in a little bit of a spot. We have a beautiful airport, which we're seeing more direct flights from Denver, Dallas, San Diego, LA, San Francisco, Seattle. You know, we have a number of direct flights, which are performing really well. But when you live here and you want to go farther out, you may have to stop more than once. But it's so well worth it. Once people get here and they realize, oh, that was worth, you know, perhaps two stops if you're coming from the East Coast.
Yeah, but it is amazing how it's changed. I mean, I used to have to go to Phoenix all the time to get anywhere. And now in United, you can go direct to Dallas, Fort Worth.
I mean, Denver.
Denver. That's my main hub now to get, you know, it's two hops to get anywhere in America.
Yep.
One stop, Denver, and then you're home.
And you can easily go to LA and go out, or go to San Francisco and go out.
A little bit more. What's closest to your heart? What are you most proud of?
I think what I'm most proud of is when I look at the team we have here at Visit SoCal and the way that we are telling the story. You know, we are 19 people working every day to really tell the story of the people that make up this region. And so we do a lot of that where we talk to the people that own the properties here, that own the experiences here. If you want to go on the Clydesdales, you know, you can do that in Cambria. And so really leaning into how we tell the story of the people that call this place home and make it special is, I think, something that I'm just really proud of.
How are you funded? Is it from occupancy tax of hotels?
We are a tourism marketing district, and so we are funded through tax that the visitor pays. And so we take that money and then we have programs that bring more visitors in so that we can fill those coffers. One of the great things about visitation and about tourism is tourism brought over $2 billion in economic impact to this community last year.
Wow.
So, you know, we had 7.4 million visitors that came in, who spent money, who stayed here. It created more than 22,000 jobs. So tourism is a great opportunity for us to bring something to the community that benefits the residents.
That being said, how did you navigate through COVID time?
We actually did really well, surprisingly, because we have so much outdoor space. We have more than 300 trails here in the region. We had so many visitors that came from the city and rented vacation rentals where they felt safe because they felt safe here and could work from anywhere. Mm-hmm. And they really wanted to enjoy the outside amenities we have. We didn't close our beaches because there's enough space for everybody to be on the beach safely. So the region actually did well during COVID from a lodging standpoint.
That's really cool. Mm-hmm. Blessing, huh?
It is a blessing.
Kathy, to learn more about your world here, where would you take us?
So if you go to follow us, you know, at SloCal, what you'll find is really just a visual transport through the region. Mm-hmm. And you'll see a little bit of everything from the beach to the wine country to the lakes to farming to all of the special things we have to offer. And my name is Kathy Cartier. I'm the president and CEO at Visit SloCal.
Awesome. Kathy, thanks for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Sign up for the Visitors Magazine and their e-newsletter at slocal.com. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the heart of San Luis Obispo County. We'll see you here.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Meher Ali. Last week, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced that it plans to add the monarch butterfly to the threatened species list by the end of 2025. This means that the butterfly will be protected under the Endangered Species Act. Devin Salva, a UCSB student reporter, spoke with researcher Ethan Anadon about the challenges facing the monarch butterfly habitats and efforts underway to save them.
If you drive north past Isla Vista, down Hollister or the 101, you'll eventually reach the Elwood Mesa and Goleta Monarch Butterfly Habitat. These 75 acres of forest, bluffs, and meadows are home to between hundreds and thousands of monarch butterflies during the months of October to March.
At the start of October, the monarchs start arriving on the central coast of California at these whole network of overwintering habitats or overwintering sites from Marin County all the way down to Baja California, San Diego, Baja California. And there's a whole network of these overwintering sites. There's over 400 that we know of and likely some that we have yet to find. And the monarch's whole goal of coming to these sites is to survive the winter. They are traveling from everywhere west of the Rocky Mountains and coming to the coast where it's not likely to freeze. Their whole goal is to survive the winter. They've spent the whole summer breeding and building a population. And then in fall, there's all of these environmental cues that trigger the whole population to migrate to the coast, survive the winter. And then in the spring, around January, they'll start mating. And then in March, they will disperse from the overwintering habitats and begin that next cycle in the migration as they repopulate the breeding habitat in spring.
That was Karis Vanderhyde, a biologist at Althaus and Mead and Santa Barbara's resident monarch expert. Every year, she organizes the monarch butterfly count with the Xerces Society. Because Karis wasn't available for an interview, the audio clips included are from a January interview with KCSB reporter Annabelle Hurst.
There's an iconic overwintering site. The most common overwintering habitat is a grove of trees. And these trees are arranged in such a way where they have a thick band around the outside and an open interior. So that outside protection protects the inside from wind and strong wind events and storms. And that open interior allows for dappled light to come through so they can warm up a bit. And they really love to cluster on the branches that come out into that open space.
This description fits the Elwood Grove exactly, making it the ideal monarch butterfly overwintering site. But monarch populations are steadily declining. According to the City of Goleta website and Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, the Western monarch populations in general and in Goleta specifically have decreased by 95% in recent years. On top of this, the Elwood Grove needs upkeep as land and wildlife is susceptible to rotting, fire, drought, and other ecological issues. Here's Ethan Anadon on Elwood's volunteer-led efforts to enhance the monarch grove.
My name's Ethan Anadon. I work for the Cheadle Center, which is a department at UCSB. We manage all of UCSB's open spaces that they have throughout campus, and we also partner with local groups to offer our expertise for projects such as the Monarch Habitat Enhancement Project. So the city of Goleta approached us, and once they approached us, we were able to offer our help in establishing native plantings and establishing the eucalyptus plantings and, you know, all that comes with the actual legwork on the ground. A lot of the eucalyptus trees in the preserve have died from the droughts. So there's a big fuels mitigation and just standing dead trees just to remove any potential danger of falling trees or fire risk. So that's kind of part of it. And then the other part is removing all these trees and having lots of trees die. The grove doesn't really offer the protection that it once did to the monarchs when they come to overwinter here. So we want to reestablish those groves functioning properly so that monarchs that are here are nice and safe from winter storms and things of that nature. And in tandem, also plant some native plantings that will promote the monarchs by offering them nectar or, you know, further sheltering them from the wind.
This planting of eucalyptus trees and native plants the Cheadle Center is doing isn't long-standing, though. It's a more recently established practice due to the fact that the monarchs haven't always migrated to Goleta, as well as the fluctuation in monarch population.
So there was like a long-standing policy, as I understand it, in Elwood to just kind of be hands-off and leave it as a natural preserve and fully natural, as in, you know, we don't do anything. What I think that we're realizing is that because these eucalyptus maybe aren't adapted to our climate, and, you know, our climate's changing so rapidly, that when we get things like these huge droughts, that a lot of them die off, and if we don't do anything about it, then we get left with lots of dead material, and, you know, we don't really want that lying around just because it's a potential fire risk, and also we don't want all that fall risk, because it's just too much risk with these trees that don't really have like the root support because they're dead, but they're still upright. They're just waiting to fall over with a big gust of wind. So they want to reduce that risk as much as possible without like increasing fuel load that could lead to potential. Obviously fire is a huge risk. There's, you know, it's adjacent basically to lots of homes. You know, we don't want any fires breaking out that could cause any damage to those. And then of course, again, there's the monarchs, which have been on a pretty steady decline, and we want to promote them as much as we can. We have one of the largest overwintering sites for the Western monarch population, so we can sort of leverage that to hopefully promote them and, you know, prevent any further decline as best we can.
But this work isn't as simple as it seems. Eucalyptus trees aren't actually native to Santa Barbara. They were brought to America from Europe in the 1770s and were planted in hopes of being used as firewood during the gold rush. The work being done in Elwood means planting more eucalyptus for the monarchs, which has sparked a debate on whether or not it's okay to be planting non-native species in what is considered a nature reserve.
It's just one of those things. It's really tricky. So basically what it is yeah, the eucalyptus are not native. So just start there. And we're planting non-native trees, which is, I would say, very different from what the Cheadle Center would normally do. What we understand of the monarchs right now is that they don't really show overwintering behavior on native trees, except for some very specific examples. They like evergreen trees. They like big, tall, coastal trees that form these groves with lots of wind protection. And there's just not that many trees that offer that. This is kind of the tree that works here. We are trying a different species of eucalyptus, which is interesting. The typical species is the blue gum eucalyptus. What we're planting primarily as core monarch grove structure is Eucara eucalyptus, which is Eucalyptus diversicolor. And that is a more drought tolerant species. It's not known to be invasive. you know, it's still non-native. It still offers like a completely different structure to the environment than would have been here native pre-eucalyptus, pre-colonialization. But hopefully, you know, it won't suck up so much water and it won't spread and take over these areas so much. And we can just kind of keep it to the core grove that the monarchs need and build out from there with natives. Which is what we've kind of done around the grove. There's a continued windbreak, which starts with eucalyptus, but works its way down. We're planting oaks, we're planting toyon, and we're working down into more of a coastal sage scrub, trying to incorporate natives, but still give the monarchs the habitat that they need, which can really only come from eucalyptus.
Ethan and his team are hoping for one thing, improvement. It won't be immediate, as is the nature of planting species that take decades to reach maturity, but it will happen eventually.
It's going to be decades, kind of is the order of magnitude that we're thinking of when we're planting these trees. All the fuels reduction work is immediate, and that's great, and it cleared up a lot of space, and it just made the area more navigable and safer. Hopefully we'll start seeing some of this habitat, this native habitat, get used in the short future. But, you know, I just don't want people to come out to the grove expecting that because we did all this work, there will now be thousands and thousands of monarchs. There might be, there might not be. You know, from what I understand, it might be kind of a quiet year. Long term, you know, decades from now, we're hoping that when these storms come, that they aren't so vulnerable. You know, if you've been out there during one of these storms, well, we have lots of them overwintering, they really can see some significant losses. So just trying to reduce those as much as we can.
To get involved with the effort, you can check out the Elwood Grove section on the City of Goleta's website. Elwood has frequent volunteer events where you can plant trees, clear out old brush, and more. On a broader level, though, this enhancement project with the monarchs is part of larger efforts to curb the effects of climate change.
It's important in that they're pollinators, so there's obviously that aspect of it. But I think they're also just like a signifier of like the greater loss of biodiversity that we've been seeing, and it's hard to, you know, pick a battle with all of that at once, but just seeing this decline of a species that's like so integral to Goleta's being, like it's, you know, it's like on the city crest and people grew up in this like really magnificent, you know, overwintering site, just seeing all these monarchs, I think it really connects with people. And I think that they offer sort of like a vessel to bring what's like really a huge global issue to people's front door.
If you want to check out Annabelle's interview with Karis, it's on the KCSB SoundCloud titled, quote, Monarchs Arrive in Goleta Butterfly Grove, a conversation with a monarch expert, end quote. Again, that was Ethan Anadon with the Cheadle Center. The music played under today's story was
Sandpiper Waltz by Chad Crouch.
Thank you for listening. This is Devin Salva with KCSB News. See you next time.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Meher Ali. We often think of running as a solitary activity, but this perception is shifting. Run clubs are gaining popularity nationwide, including along the Central Coast. These clubs provide more than a fitness outlet. They foster friendships, motivation, and even help ease loneliness. One of these is the Run Slow Club, which brings together runners of all skill levels.
So, like I was saying,
Natalie Rodriguez once dreamed of competing at the Olympic level. At California State University San Marcos, she was a two-time All-American on the cross-country and track team, and she still holds school records in the 1500 and 5K. But in 2020, burnout and the pandemic drained her enthusiasm, and she stepped away from competitive running. For Rodriguez, running had always been personal. A realization that it could also be a rewarding communal experience rekindled her love for the sport. And in 2024, the San Luis Obispo resident founded the Run Slow Club.
I had started hearing about all these running clubs kind of coming up all over and kind of just realized that Slow had a need, and then totally expected there to be like 10 people to show up, and then it blew up.
The club grew rapidly and now draws as many as 90 members at a meetup. Rodriguez says,
all of a sudden, it just kept increasing little by little each week.
According to the Sports and Fitness Industry Association, running participation hit an all-time high in 2023, with over 60 million Americans embracing the sport. A survey by Running USA found that nearly 50% of runners join clubs to meet like-minded people and build relationships. Rodriguez tapped into this enthusiasm when she started her free running club. To launch the first meetup, she created an Instagram page and connected with individuals from local gyms and runners who participated in races in the area. After every run, members of Slow Run Club gather at local spots like Field Day Coffee or Libertine Brewing, turning the endorphin rush into a social event.
You just get to the end and go, oh, thank God, like I can neck down a beer and just talk about the run, talk about what you're doing on the day-to-day with someone else. Because you never really know who you're going to meet beforehand, sometimes those are the people that you end up with chatting with afterwards.
That's landscape architect Damian Knight, originally from Australia and now a San Luis Obispo resident. He's a regular at Slow Run Club events and says he's seen friendships form and romance bloom within the club.
It's nice to be physically interacting with people and starting conversations with people as opposed to doing it through an app. Sure, apps serve their purpose, especially during COVID. But I think it was high time for some genuine face-to-face interactions to be had.
Rodriguez says the club is an ideal setting for making bonds, combining good conversation with physical activity and a shared sense of accomplishment.
What's great about running is that it's such an open sport. And I think that really opens up people's sense of like authenticity. I'm happy that it's a space where people can feel like they can genuinely meet somebody.
Although an elite runner herself, Rodriguez emphasizes that the club is open to all, with members ranging from seasoned marathoners to first timers.
And I try really hard to make it a space where, you know, anyone is welcome. And if you aren't feeling yourself that day, like, please walk and just listen to your body and just do you.
Beyond camaraderie, running clubs are transforming how people connect in an increasingly digital world. A 2023 study by Running USA found that runners in clubs are 40% more likely to stick with their fitness goals compared to those who run solo. For Natalie, watching her club evolve into a dynamic and inclusive community has been deeply fulfilling. She likes to say that Run Slow Club isn't about speed. It's about showing up, sharing the experience, and being a part of something bigger.
And, you know, with the Run Club, I had a feeling that would contribute to me kind of falling in love with it again. I get myself out of the door twice a week, every week, and get to hang out with my friends, and it's fun.
For KCBX News, I'm Melissa Toledo.
This reporting was made possible by a grant from the Shanbrom Family Foundation. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.